Yeah, good morning. So, this is the idea. So, thanks for the invitation to this interesting conference. I've been asked to give a report on an overview on the topic of biogenesis, and I would like to do this with emphasis on the question to what extent the different models for biogenesis can be fortified in the next couple of years by means of, well, hopefully results from NHC, and also due to new results, hopefully, from astrophysics. And I think that in that respect, the connection, the close connection of the different models of biogenesis with dark matter will in fact play a crucial role. And that's why I chose this title. So here's the outline. I'll start with a couple of general comments on matter-antimatter asymmetry. And then I'll briefly discuss electroweak status of electroweak biogenesis, Affleck-Dein biogenesis. And then I'll spend more time on thermal leptogenesis, which has been quite active field during the past few years. And then finally, I would like to discuss a little bit some recent work which we have been doing at DAISY on a particular version of dark matter, namely gravitino dark matter, which is motivated or even suggested maybe by leptogenesis. So this is the outline. Now, every talk on this topic starts, of course, with Sakharov's conditions, so also my one. But since the paper was written more than 40 years ago and not everybody may have read it, let me just add one thing to these conditions. Sakharov also, in his very interesting paper, which is only 3-4 pages long, in fact, provides a model of how to realize these conditions for baryogenesis. And so what he suggests is that the origin of the matter-antimatter asymmetry are in fact CP-violating decays of maximons, very heavy particles with a mass of order M Planck and more or less in equilibrium at a temperature of the order of M Planck. And then he develops a model where he tries to connect the CP violation, which he has in maximon decays, with CP violation at that time in the K system. And then he has something to say about some lepton number violation between muon and electron processes, which I forgot. And finally, he makes a prediction for the proton lifetime, namely that it's longer than 10 to the 50 years, which still remains to be falsified. So in some sense, the model is still okay. Okay, and in some sense, also what we are doing today is more or less the same. I mean, that is, we try to develop some model for biogenesis and try to fit it into particle physics and see how to relate the CP violation, which leads to the baryon asymmetry, to some low energy observables, and make some predictions. And I think, in fact, clearly baryon proton decay, proton instability, is one of the crucial aspects. But also now dark matter, as I would like to emphasize, is a very interesting observable to distinguish the different mechanisms. Now, you know, there are various ways to realize the Sakharov's conditions as classical gap baryogenesis, and maybe the modern version of that is leptogenesis, electroweak baryogenesis, and the Affleck-Dein mechanism. But there are two crucial non-perturbative properties of the standard model, which are the basis of all this, and that has already been discussed at this meeting. The electroweak phase transition, which now we know what the phase diagram is, so that has very important implications of what happens to the baryon asymmetry there. And then the Sfalaron processes, which give us a connection between baryon lepton number violation in the high temperature phase. So Mikolajn already reviewed the status of our current understanding of the electroweak phase transition. So let me just emphasize or repeat one point once more. As you know, there was a long activity on that, and many here, I think, in the room contributed to that business. And in some sense, the endpoint maybe of this theoretical investigation was the determination of the endpoint by maybe Chico and Frodo, the endpoint in this phase diagram, which gives, in the 4D lattice simulation, which gives a number of about 72 GeV. Beyond which there is no first-order phase transition anymore, but just a crossover. Now, the important point, I think, here is that this number is far below the lower bound from LEMP. It's not just, say, 2, 3 GeV, but it's a factor of almost 2. And I think this is what makes, in fact, electroweak barrier genesis, as we see later, not very easy, because you really have to do a lot in order to make the phase transition sufficiently strong so that you can still have electroweak barrier genesis. It's really, and as you know, or maybe the younger ones don't know, there is this interesting thing that during the time the theorists were working on the electroweak phase diagram, the bound got lower and lower, and at the same time the left bound moved up and up. So by the time it was finished, the upper bound, sort of on this mass from theory, was a factor of 2 below the lower bound of the experimental situation from LEMP. Now, the other point, the really crucial point, of course, is the connection between baryon and lepton number violating processes in the high temperature phase. We had already discussion of that yesterday by Jan Smith, and you know, it is now generally, I would say, accepted that these processes are in thermal equilibrium roughly between 100 GeV and 10 to the 12 GeV. And as it was pointed out yesterday also, this remarkably, this temperature range remained constant despite all the progress made on the theoretical understanding of this process, which may make you worry a little bit. So there's one point I would like to make here. Given the importance of this, I think it would be very nice also to have some experimental evidence that these processes are really there. And because it's just at the moment a theoretical calculation, and the various groups, I think, by now agree, but there's no direct evidence for that. Now, there has been a serious effort to see these instanton processes at HERA in QCD, by work over a couple of years by Ringwald and Schramm, but it's very difficult. I mean, the data look not bad, but on the other hand, the background processes are so severe that it's at the moment not possible to really make a definite statement. But I think one should not forget the problem. I mean, people are further analyzing the data. Maybe there are new possibilities at LHC. We heard something here, some interesting work about classical field configurations, even in heavy ion collisions. I mean, maybe one can isolate somewhere these processes. I think that would really be a very important thing to do. Now, as you know, taking this connection between baryon lepton number as given, you know that in thermal equilibrium, a baryon asymmetry is related to a lepton asymmetry, and the ratio is about roughly a factor of a third if you average or you sum overall the lepton flavors. I will not discuss the flavor dependence of this now. Now, this suggests that once you generate a baryon asymmetry in the high temperature phase, that then lepton number violation is in fact needed, or B minus L violation is needed, in order to have a non-vanishing baryon asymmetry. And on the other hand, what is clear is that if you have too much of that, say too much lepton number violation, then those lepton number violating processes will give you zero chemical potential for lepton asymmetry, and therefore also zero baryon asymmetry, so they will wash out this. So you need the right amount of lepton number violation at the right time in order to generate properly a baryon asymmetry. And this, I think, as we will see, is in fact sort of nicely done. It automatically comes out in the right way, I would say, leptogenesis. for reasons which were not guaranteed. I think it depends on just the fact, it just depends on the values of the neutrino masses. So in some sense, the value of the neutrino masses play for leptogenesis the same role as does the Higgs mass for electroweak baryogenesis. So the fact that the Higgs mass is much bigger than the mass which we get from the phase diagram at the end of the critical line makes life not so easy for electroweak baryogenesis, whereas if neutrino masses, if you would have evidence, say, now for two electron volt neutrino masses, which I think is compatible with, there would not be nothing wrong with that, then leptogenesis would be in trouble. So I'll come back to that point. So, but that's really the way what is crucial for leptogenesis. So let me move on to electroweak baryogenesis. So here is, I think, the process you have seen many times. So we have first order phase transition, the formation of bubbles with the true vacuum inside the false vacuum. Inside you get a big VEF for the Higgs field, so the Fallon processes are suppressed, outside not. And then you have CP violating deflections, that's a bubble wall, and that is a very intricate and beautiful mechanism in principle to generate an asymmetry. In fact, I think many of these ideas were developed here in Santa Barbara at a program a couple of years ago, where I also had the pleasure to participate, and I think that was at that time the work by Cohen, Kaplan, and Nelson, who in fact I still remember were discussing it very lively here in Santa Barbara during that workshop. And I remember a talk, I think, given by Ann Nelson at some point, saying, giving a number for the baryon asymmetry as a Fermi constant times m tau, the tau lepton mass squared, which happens also to be 10 to the minus 10. Now, by now we know there are a few more factors involved in this process. And clearly there are many ways to get the number of 10 to the minus 10 for the baryon asymmetry as a product of various numbers. And so I will also give you a few other examples. Now, then, of course, we know in the standard model, it's not possible anymore to have electroweak baryogenesis because of the very strict, and we have this bound on the Higgs mass. However, it is still viable to have electroweak baryogenesis in extensions, like two Higgs doublet model. We saw one discussion, I think, in Nicolaides' talk, where you add a dimension 6 operator and then, therefore, can go to larger, can vary the Higgs self-coupling and, therefore, make the phase transition more strongly first order. And then, of course, there is a supersymmetric extension of the standard model, where it's also still possible to have electroweak phase transition. Although, one must say, one gets a rather strong constraints on parameters, and I have here plotted or given you two examples of two groups who have pursued this direction during the past couple of years, the Chicago group, and what they get here is constraints in the Higgs mass, the plane of the Higgs mass, and the stop, right-handed stop. And as you know, what you need is you need a rather light stop to realize that in this context, with the other supersymmetric particles rather heavy, with masses of the order of TeV. So you need a somewhat, I would say, exceptional supersymmetric mass spectrum, but it's still possible. Also, if you look at the relations which you have between the mu parameter in the MSSM and the Gugino mass, you also are driven to somewhat low values here, and you see this black area, which in fact is allowed, where you can have successful electroweak baryogenesis. So it is still possible, but it will be clearly tested at the LHC. And also, what is interesting is if you move away, if you try to relax these constraints by going away from the minimal model, say the minimal, the MSSM to the NMSSM or so, then you relax some of the constraints, but you get some others. And so you always have some light degrees of freedom in the end, which I think is quite interesting. So this is here a plot from the work again of Carlos Wagner and company, and what is shown here is the following. It is, of course, once you have a supersymmetric model, then of course it's natural to have neutralino dark matter in that context, and you may ask what are the constraints that I on the parameters, or is it possible to have at the same time electroweak biogenesis and neutralino dark matter. So these points here give you correspond to parameters or to models where electroweak biogenesis is possible, and these points are plotted here as a function of the LSP mass. And you see, if you now also want a value of omega, dark matter of about 0.1, you are driven here again to rather small values of the LSP mass. So what I find interesting about that is that whatever you do, if you look at some of the models, if you want to have something which is cosmologically consistent, based on the phase transition, the biogenesis, and dark matter, you typically end up with some light, really light degrees of freedom. So I think we can be very optimistic that a lot of that will be really tested at the LHC. So much for electroweak biogenesis. So let me move on to Aflatoxin biogenesis now. You know, this is a very generic and typical case in the supersymmetric standard model, simply because you have flat directions before supersymmetry is broken, and you have other effects like neutrino masses or so which lift these flat directions. And you can then see what those flat directions do. Typically during inflation, you are driven to large expectation values for scalar condensates, so that could be a scalar condensate of these two fields or these three fields, such that you have zero D terms. And then after inflation, you have coherent oscillations when the Hubble parameter temperature is as small that the Hubble parameter is equal to the mass. And then the baryon and lepton numbers stored in these scalar condensates is by a rather, I would say, tricky mechanism turned into baryon lepton number of ordinary quarks and leptons. So it's, I think, maybe the best example of non-thermal biogenesis. Now, it seems to me that this mechanism is rather flexible. So, I mean, you still have many uncertainties, and it seems difficult to falsify. So, on the other hand, one may ask the question, when would I believe it? So, what are observations which would strongly point in this direction? And I think this again has to do with dark matter. So one possibility is, I think, cuboids. Cuboids you can have in this flat direction. And so these are stable macroscopic objects with very large baryon number, say of the order of 10 to the 26. And then these things would be formed when the scalar condensates decay. So this is a plot taken here from this review of Dine and Kruzenko. So where this is the time axis, it's a one-dimensional simulation, and here you have the condensate, and then as time goes on, the condensate breaks up, and you form lumps of these cuboids. So that could be, in principle, a non-thermal mechanism to generate a particular form of dark matter. And in fact, bounds have already been produced on the existence of such cuboids by the Baikal experiment. It's going on now with Amanda and IceCube and by Superkami-Yokande. And if something like this would be found, I mean, if you would really have such a type of dark matter, then I think it would really point towards this would have to be something completely different from ordinary thermal production of dark matter, particle dark matter, and it would point to the importance of scalar dynamics, the dynamics of scalar fields in the early universe. So I think this would be very interesting. Another possibility is the following. These cue balls, it depends now on the details of the MSSM, don't have to be necessarily stable. So they could be unstable, and you could generate in the decays, for instance, a Higgsinos as dark matter, Higgsino dark matter. However, the parameters which you then have, that means the mass of this dark matter, would be different from the ones which you would need for thermal production. So suppose, so an example is given here from the work of Fuji Hamaguchi. So what is allowed here is this red region. So that means you see a certain range here of masses of M1/2 and M0 in this plane. So if you would find at LHC some Higgsino as LSP with parameters inconsistent with the observed abundance of dark matter from thermal production, then again that could be just some hint for non-thermal production mechanism, and one possibility would then be something like this. So I think it's very interesting to see how, in fact, the observed dark matter, which we can hope that we will learn something at the LHC, how that will have an impact also on our understanding of the Wegener symmetry. Now let me move on to leptogenesis, and I'll just confine myself to the simplest version, namely thermal leptogenesis, where you produce a right hemi neutrinos thermally. I will not discuss all the work on non-thermal leptogenesis. Maybe Marco will say something about that. Okay, so it's complementary talks. Now, you know, it's also a rather old idea proposed by Fukugita Yanagida almost 20 years ago, and for almost 10 years not much attention was paid to it because everybody was busy with electroweak cryogenesis. If you are really interested in the topic, about a week ago, a very detailed review appeared by David Zanardi and Mir, where you can find lots of details discussed with many references. Now, as you know, the basis of this is just the seesaw mechanism. There are by now various versions of this, so I will just stick to the simplest form, just the standard model with three right-handed neutrinos, one per family, and then you know you have the seesaw formula, and you have as mass eigenstates six Majorana fermions, three heavy and three light. And then, as you also know, if you have then also in the neutrino sector for the Dirac neutrinos couplings order one, like for the top quarks, then you see that the scale of neutrino masses which we observe, something like 0.01 eV, is in fact nicely consistent with M3, the mass of the heaviest of the right-handed neutrinos of the order of the gut scale. So in this naive and simplest picture, we are probing with neutrino physics, gut scale physics. If you see if the mass differences which we see here are of the order of the masses themselves, and that I think is what many people find very interesting about neutrino physics and the seesaw mechanism. Now, what is also interesting is that, in fact, the right-handed neutrinos, which you get because of neutrino physics, are ideal candidates for biogenesis. And this is nothing which you now have to introduce in addition. It just comes for free. And the reason is that these neutrinos are just very weakly coupled to the thermal plasma. You have just a Yukawa interaction. In particular, the lightest of them typically has a coupling of, say, 10 to the minus 5, Yukawa coupling. So it's very weakly coupled to the thermal plasma, and because of that is an object which can easily get out of thermal equilibrium, and therefore then produce NCP violating decays by Wegener symmetry. Now, you then get, in such decays, you generate an asymmetry in lepton number, in B minus L, and therefore, by means of the Sphalerone processes, also a baryon asymmetry. Now, work on this started, I think, by several groups, again around 96, some time ago, when it became clear that the electroweak phase transition was rather weak, and it was not so clear whether how well electroweak baryogenesis would work. And the expectation based on this work was also that the neutrino masses, which you need in leptogenesis, should be rather small, already in the early times. And then, as you know, after the discovery of neutrino masses, the evidence from neutrino oscillations, leptogenesis really had a certain boom, because it turned out that the observations in neutrino physics worked very well together with leptogenesis. Now, before I discuss the recent theoretical status of that, let me just repeat once more that, in fact, you can understand in this mechanism, also in a very simple way, how you generate the right order of magnitude for the baryon asymmetry. And this works as follows. You have the CP violation in the decay, which is the decay width into lepton Higgs minus the decay width into anti-lepton Higgs divided by the sum. And if you work this out, you get the imaginary part of a product of a Yukawa coupling. And here you have the light neutrino mass matrix. And here you have the lightest one of the heavy neutrinos, which typically generates the asymmetry, divided again by this the product of Yukawa couplings. Now, roughly, if you want to make a rough estimate, Yukawa couplings appear twice here and also here. So if you roughly drop that and assume that it's dominated the thing by the largest eigenvalue, then you get for the CP asymmetry a certain factor, which is 0.1. And then the product of this, the mass of the heavy neutrino times the heaviest mass of the light neutrinos over the Higgs squared. And if you then again use the seesaw formula, you get a number of 0.1 times the ratio of the lightest of the heavy neutrinos to the heaviest ones. So this is sort of a back of the envelope estimate before, if you don't know anything. Now, if you now take typical values, say suppose the right-handed neutrinos come in some gut model with a family structure similar to what you know for the quarks, you may expect a ratio, mass ratio, like for up quarks or down quarks or charged leptons of 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 5. So typically you can get a CP asymmetry here of about 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 6. So if you take this number multiplied with the dilution factor, which comes thermodynamically because the number density of photons increases by two orders of magnitude as you go from the region of leptogenesis to today, then, so you have a factor 10 to the minus 2 here, you have the CP asymmetry, and then some additional factor which contains all the non-equilibrium dynamics, which may be 0.1 or 10 to the minus 2, then you see that you end up with the right amount. So I think this, I find, is of course not a proof. You can have very different models of neutrino masses and particle physics, and you can generate also other numbers. But at least I think it illustrates that in a very simple model, which you may guess as a particle theorist of what the mass spectrum might be, you can see where the number of 10 to the minus 10 comes from. And in fact, it turns out that the neutrino masses which we now observe are also in a range which I would say are theory friendly. That means they make the theory for this rather easy, I would say. So, and therefore rather robust. So that one may be able in the long run to really get a full theoretical understanding of that, which I find interesting. And that has to do with the departure from thermal equilibrium, which you have in the generation of the baryon asymmetry. So these heavy neutrinos are not in thermal equilibrium. There's a usual condition if their decay width, or they are in thermal equilibrium, if the decay width is larger than the Hubble rate, as you know, and they are not if it's smaller than the Hubble rate. Now you can turn that into a condition on neutrino masses in the following way. You can define an effective neutrino mass. This is a Dirac neutrino mass, and you have MD, MB dagger. The 1-1 element of this over divided by the mass of the lightest of the heavy neutrinos. This is similar to the seesaw formula. And you know that this effective mass is always larger than the lightest eigenvalue of the light neutrino mass matrix, and it's typically in models smaller than the heaviest one. And this M star, then you get from by looking here at the Hubble parameter, and you just evaluate it to be 10 to the minus 3 eV. Now, what is interesting about this number, so this number of 10 to the minus 3 eV, this effective neutrino mass, defines sort of a borderline between equilibrium and out of equilibrium. Typically, if you have neutrino masses above that, you are in equilibrium. Of course, you're never exactly in equilibrium. There's always some out of equilibrium, but you are close to equilibrium. If you are below, you get more and more out of equilibrium. So the fact that these mass differences which you observe are close to that number, a little bit above, already may suggest that this leptogenesis process is something close to thermal equilibrium, which would have the advantage that usually that's a region where you can do calculations rather reliable. You don't have a wild out of equilibrium process, but something where the departure from equilibrium is small. Okay, so the standard treatment then of this is Boltzmann equations, which, I mean, now has become much more sophisticated in many ways. I will comment on that in the end. But in the simplest case, of course, you have the decay of these right-handed neutrinos, where you always have the difference between the actual number density and the equilibrium density, and you have a decay term here and a scattering term. And so the first process is decay and inverse decay, where the decay goes into lepton Higgs and the inverse decay the other way around. And then you have two-to-two scattering processes. And then you have processes which violate lepton number by 2 units, described by a washout term. And instead of time, I've used the unit here, the mass divided by temperature. That's the standard treatment. And in fact, it turns out that in the region where the neutrino masses lie, or where the neutrino mass differences lie, the ones which we know from observation, it turns out that the process is dominated, really, just by decays and inverse decays. So it's sort of the simplest thing, as discussed in the old paper by Kolb and Wolfram many years ago for just ordinary gut baryogenesis. And there, things are so simple that you can do the basic calculations essentially analytically, which is also interesting if you think about extending the Boltzmann treatment to a more complicated and elaborate time of pain treatment later. Now, the typical graph which you then have for the generation of the baryon asymmetry is this. You have here the abundance of the right-handed neutrinos. You either start in thermal equilibrium, which will be here, and then you have the decay, or you can also start from zero, and then the various interactions of these right-handed neutrinos bring them quickly into thermal equilibrium. And then later, there is a period where you have a small departure from thermal equilibrium, and during that time, you generate the asymmetry, and this is the thing shown here, and this is what survives in the end. If you would start from zero, you get also during this period where you have a departure, you get a generation of a baryon asymmetry with the opposite sign, and in the end, you can have some delicate cancellation effect. So these are some typical values, this M1 tilde, 10 to the minus 3 eV, and M1, 10 to the 10 eV. So this is a typical plot which you get, which many people have generated in the meantime, and for your favorite model, you can then calculate the baryon asymmetry. Now, there has been, during the past years, I think, considerable progress in making this simplest model more quantitative. And the main ingredients there are the following. One is, in fact, an upper bound of the CP asymmetry by Hamaguchi et al. And Davidson and Ibarra, which tells you that the CP asymmetry has an upper bound given by the lightest of the right-handed neutrinos. So that means if you make these heavy neutrinos too light, then you just don't have enough CP asymmetry to generate the needed baryon asymmetry. So you are in trouble. So that gives you a mass that gives you a mass on a bound of the mass of the lightest of the light in neutrinos and related on the heating temperature which you need in the early universe. The other thing is a better treatment, better understanding of the washout processes, which you have delta L equal to 2 washout processes which you have in the plasma, which erase any generated asymmetry. And those, and the results, so several groups worked on that. Here I have, I show you two plots from our own work, which shows the following. One is this so-called efficiency factor, which is essentially the baryon asymmetry. So you divide out the CP asymmetry and some kinematic factor as a function of this mass M1 tilde. And you see here this value of 10 to the minus 3, which is a dividing line between equilibrium and out of equilibrium. And now if you go to the left, that means for very small neutrino masses, where you would be out of equilibrium, you see that this efficiency factor and therefore the final baryon asymmetry which you generate has a considerable uncertainty, which goes over several orders of magnitude. So you are strongly dependent on the initial condition. It makes a big difference whether you start in thermal equilibrium or you start with initial density zero. In one case you are here, in the other case you are in this band. Now this band depends then on also on your theory. I mean, what kind of processes you take into account. Whether in order to generate these right-handed neutrinos you use W scattering with W bosons or just decays and inverse decays. Whether you include interactions with the top quark and so on. So for once you are at very small neutrino masses here, very small M1 tilde, then you have a considerable uncertainty in your final prediction. But what is interesting is once you move with these masses above this 10 to the minus 3, and that's the range where the mass differences lie, what we get from solar and atmospheric neutrino oscillations, then all this uncertainty disappears and all these things move into this band. So you are left with an uncertainty only of a factor of about 2. So I think you have a very robust prediction for the simplest model, where you are independent, really, of the initial conditions, and to a large extent, independent of the theory. So in here, everything is dominated just by decays and inverse decays. The thing becomes very simple, and therefore very stable. So in that sense, I would say these neutrino masses are really theory-friendly. I mean, there are, Well, the point is once you are with the neutrino masses in this range, decays and inverse decays, although weak, are sufficiently strong to first bring the right-handed neutrinos into equilibrium. So that means the way this works is, first you bring the right-handed neutrinos into equilibrium, and then later, at a temperature which is, say, maybe a factor of 10 below the mass of the right-handed neutrinos, when they are non-relativistic, they decay. So you have controlled initial conditions. In fact, there is another thing which is quite remarkable, which I don't have time to explain. But if you have any other asymmetry, baryon asymmetry, generated by some other mechanism at earlier times, that will be erased by the exchange. So these right-handed neutrinos with these neutrino masses act a little bit like a vacuum cleaner. They erase the memory of the past, they bring you to thermal equilibrium, and then they decay. And they decay and give you the right amount of baryon asymmetry. Well, the right amount we don't know, but I mean it's, at least it's something which is very stable. Now, so here from this, in order for that to be in equilibrium, you get, or to be independent of initial conditions, you in fact have now a lower bound of the neutrino masses, and what is now called single flavor approximation, if you sum over the flavors, you also have an upper bound of about 0.EV, which I will discuss on the next transparency, is flavor dependent. And then what you have here is a lower bound of the reheating temperature. You get a lower bound of about 10 to the 9 GeV on the reheating temperature from this analysis. So that means you are forced by, first of all, a neutrino mass window is singled out, which, however, as you see here, fits very well together with our current evidence for neutrino masses, and you are driven to high temperatures. Now, there has been, that's a minimal picture. Now there has been much work, recently interesting work, on the problems of that picture.
Yeah, I think I have a problem.
And that has to do with flavor effects, which were discussed by two groups, Abara et al. And Nardi et al. And there were many papers on that. Here, so far, the Boltzmann equations, which I discussed, summed over the flavors in the finite state. However, that is usually, or not always, I should say, justified. It depends on the model, because it can be that at these high temperatures, some of the charged lepton interactions are in thermal equilibrium and some are not. And that generates dependence, so that strictly this upper bound of the neutrino masses, which I 0.1 eV, which I quoted on the previous transparency, is invalid. But the question is now what happens to that? Now, first, to illustrate the effect, this is the baryon asymmetry with or without the flavor effects included. And now, of course, here parameters are chosen a little bit extreme, but you can see you can enhance the baryon asymmetry by additional flavor, by additional CP phases by about 2 orders of magnitude. So that can have an effect. And here is what is shown here is the allowed region in the M1 and little M1, the heavy and light neutrino plane. And the question is now, what constraints do you have in neutrino masses? If you go to very heavy M1s, you see here a line which corresponds to the one flavor analysis. Here also you are at that. So in the range of masses, light and neutrino up to 10 to the 10 GV and above 10 to the 12, you have no change of the picture. But in between, you may have a difference. And this is currently under investigation, how big the effect is. That's a complicated region called intermediate regime. And there, I think it's really important to go beyond Boltzmann equations. So people are studying now, they're really the density matrices and the flavor dependence of that. And the question is to study the flavor dependence systematically. So I think this is one reason, one very important reason, to go beyond Boltzmann equations in this analysis. And of course, one possible framework, there are Kalanoff-Baym equations, and which were looked at already before in different contexts recently. And I think, given the fact that the basic process for leptogenesis is so simple, one may have a chance to really go systematically beyond the Boltzmann treatment. Now, what I would hope for the outcome is that you get something which remains close to Boltzmann equations. However, it would be important to really calculate the corrections and to see what really the error bar is on the final baryon asymmetry which you calculate for given neutrino masses and mixings. So I have no time to discuss that in more detail, but I think that is an interesting thing, and some groups are working on that, and I think we can hope for some progress. So now I think I have a problem with time, because now I come to my last section, which is in fact our recent work on the gravitino dark matter, which I think I will not have time, so maybe I can have 2-3 minutes just to discuss it. I mean, as you know, there is since the early days of supergravity, the so-called gravitino problem, which tells you that you have to be careful with the gravitinos in supergravity, because if they decay, they're just gravitationally, that happens after BBN, and then the energy which you dump into the plasma may destroy the primordial abundances. That was pointed out already by Weinberg, I think, in 82. The most stringent bounds, now there are several groups working on that and producing bounds. The most stringent ones are claimed by Kawasaki et al. They give an upper bound on the reading temperature here in the extreme case of 10 to the 5 GeV. Now, if this is true, there is clearly a clash between this and the requirement from leptogenesis that the temperature is above, at least in the simplest models, above 10 to the 9 GeV. So what to do? Well, one possibility is non-thermal leptogenesis, but even then, this is a very stringent bound. But another interesting possibility is, in fact, to make the gravitinos the lightest. once you have the gravitino, the lightest, then you just have to worry about the abundance. And with respect to the next lightest, which then, concerning the BBN problems, would play the role of the gravitino, you then have much more freedom and you can somehow adjust these problems. So, anyway, so that has now been studied by different groups over the years. And let me, which unfortunately I don't have time now to go through that in detail. In principle, there are two processes. There is a production of this from Wim decay of gravitinos. Another is just the thermal production in the early universe. And there, in fact, this is drives you to very high masses, and therefore it's not very viable in view of LHC physics. Whereas this, what is interesting about just the thermal production is that you get a binary symmetry, that you get an amount of dark matter of the right order of what is observed for reheating temperature, which is what you need for leptogenesis, if the gravitino mass and the gluino mass are of the order of what you expect for from supergravity. Now, that may just be a misleading coincidence, but it could also be very interesting, saying that thermal leptogenesis together with gravitino dark matter could give you a cosmologically consistent picture. Now, I've shown you these three graphs which contribute to this, just to point out that there are not so many, and it would be very nice to improve this calculation. Because so far, the calculation of this formula, which I showed on the previous transparency, is based on the leading order calculation with an improved resummation for the gluon propagator, which you need to eliminate an infrared divergence, which appears here in the, for the gluon in the T-channel. And that regulates logarithmic infrared divergence of the form log temperature over thermal gluon mass. And the trouble is now that the thermal gluon mass, which parametrically is G times T, is in fact, if you put in the numbers, then the gluon mass is almost exactly T. The reason is the coupling is not so small. It's 0.85, even the QCD coupling, even at 10 to the 10 GeV. And you have a supersymmetric plasma, which is where you have twice as many degrees of freedom as in the ordinary one. And that together means that you don't really have the separation of scales, which you usually need, T squared T, GT, and T. So I think it would be very interesting. So you cannot really hope for very good convergence of this perturbative expansion. I would not trust these numbers, say, better than a factor of 2, and it would be very interesting really to improve that calculation. Anyway, this is more technical point. Maybe here are people who can really do that. But the point I really wanted to say now is that you can get a consistent picture by in models where where you have a small amount of R-parity breaking. There, these gravitinos become, that's recent work here of these people, at DESY, Kobe, Yamaguchi, Ibarra, Yanagida, and myself. And what you can get there is you can get a breaking of R parity whose strength is related to the spontaneous breaking of B minus L. So that can be, say, a factor of 10 to the minus 7 here. And then you get some very interesting effects. You get you would get very specific signatures at the LHC, namely macroscopic tracks, in the case that the scale of tau is the NLSP. And you would also get a long lifetime for the gravitino, typically of the order of 10 to the 26, 27 seconds. So that would mean all the supersymmetric stuff decays via R-parity violating detection, and also the NLSP before BBN, and all that is left is the gravitino. And however, the effect of this you can leads to a gamma flux, a flux of photons. And about a year ago, when we wrote this paper, we got somewhat excited. I mean, just for consistency, we wanted to check whether the generated flux of photons was consistent with observation. And observation means essentially the EGRET data. Currently in this energy range for, on gammas. That means, in, and But then we learned that, in fact, there was an excess, known already since a number of years, which, according to the analysis of these people, which is the most recent analysis, shows a very interesting feature here at a few GeV. And this is, in fact, would be very well consistent with what one would expect in our model. So if you work this out, well, you have to and compare that now to the flux and so on. This is not a fit to the data. It just shows you the order of magnitude which you expect from extragalactic and halo contributions to the gamma flux with these data. So you see you get roughly something of the same order of magnitude. There is considerable uncertainty in this data plot, so in this data point, so we don't know yet really what I think the data there are. Somewhat, this is under the assumption that a gravitino of the order of 10 GeV decays just into neutrino photon. In a somewhat better fit or description of the data, you get for somewhat heavier gravitino. This is the 150 GeV, where in addition to the photon neutrino, you have also Z neutrino and W charged lepton. And then the Z and the W can fragment and generate also photons. And then you get a continuous spectrum. And in addition to the continuous spectrum, then also still this peak here, which you get from gamma neutrino. Now, if you compare something like this, say, to WIMP annihilation, there is a crucial difference. For WIMP annihilation, the continuum really dominates, and you have a tiny thing at the end. Whereas here, you have a very pronounced peak. I mean, you have the pronounced peak if it's just gamma nu is the only decay, or also if it's a decay in addition to the others. So even once you have a continuum, you get a very pronounced peak. Now, this is something which, if true, we may know within the next, I would say, one and a half years. Because BLAST will be launched, I think, in May. And if this exists, they should see it. So we shall see. I mean, if GLAST sees a peak, it's very interesting. If they see this in any case, whatever it is, if they see the peak soon, it will be very difficult, I think, or not very natural to relate that to WIMP annihilation. In something like decaying dark matter, for which then the gravitino is an interesting candidate, would, I think, give a very good explanation. Now, I'm a little bit more conservative. Alejandro Ibarra usually says what you can then do with the signal is, we had recently a corresponding little workshop in Padua, then this way you get early universe thermometer. Because from the density of the gravitino, you're simply measuring the mass, and then the Guido mass, you, in this way, you simply see from the density, the temperature in the universe, the production of thermal. Okay, so for the summary, I think the first thing, well, here, this audience, one does not have to emphasize that, but I think all the baryogenesis business was really based on the progress concerning the understanding of this non-perturbative aspect of the standard model. And what I find interesting is that the various models will be strongly restricted or constrained and falsified, I think, to a large extent, by the LHC. And for leptogenesis, I have still, if I would have a wish free, I would say what I would want is from the structure formation, a measurement for the sum of neutrino masses, say, of 0.07 or 0.08. The reason is we know now, say, if it would be 0.05, we don't really know what the lightest of the neutrino masses is. If it's 0.07 or 0.08, then we know that the lightest one has a mass also of 0.01 or 0.02. So we know with the mass of the lightest one, we are above this lower bound of 10 to the minus 3. And if this is the case, you are for leptogenesis, you would be in the perfect regime, where the process is, I would say, maximally stable. Okay, and then, okay, sorry, one thing, if you would see, this I think is also interesting, if you would see an ordinary supergravity type spectrum at LHC with the neutralino WIMP, that I think would falsify the simplest version of thermal leptogenesis simply because of this clash in the reheating temperature. So there is, I think, no way out, and then one needs something else which should show up in connection with the dark matter.
Thank you very much. I think we have time for a couple of questions.
You see, there's this. You say there's this clash between these reheating temperatures, but in most of what you showed us for analyzing this leptogenesis, you used rate equations, and rate equations, the distribution itself doesn't really appear. You integrate over all modes, so whether you have a thermal distribution or a non-thermal one, if you integrate over it, it doesn't look that different. So would it really be so different, your analysis, just using Rayleigh equations, if you would think of a non-thermal distribution?
Well, I mean, we did, of course, I showed only Rayleigh equations, but of course, we did at some point also, for the writing neutrinos, for instance, calculate the distribution functions. Now, if you start with zero initial conditions, then you see that what you generate is a thermal distribution of writing neutrinos. And but I think that cannot,
because for the gravitino production you just need kind of need a characteristic size of your distribution with the highest energy, and that should be 10 to the 5 GeV. So if you had a distribution that would strongly be peaked below 10 to the 5 GeV in the infrared, don't you think you could still make these rate equations work? I'm not sure about these details you just said, but could you think of a non-thermal distribution that could serve both?
No,
even thinking about the temperature, but just out of equilibrium.
Well, I think the gravitinos as well as the right-handed neutrinos are produced from a thermal bath. So if you, at a certain temperature, I mean, this is a basic picture. You know, you have, say, particles like which have gauge interactions, like lepton doublets, Higgs doublets. They are have strong interactions, gauge interactions, and are in thermal equilibrium. And then you just calculate the distribution function of the right-handed neutrinos and the gravitinos, which you produce from this bath, and you find that you produce something which has a thermal distribution. So I think within the thermal picture, there's no problem. I mean, you have, for the neutrinos, for the gravitinos, one can say you produce a thermal distribution function, although the normalization is many orders of magnitude below the equilibrium value. So you have something which is, in that sense, far out of equilibrium, but the shape of the function is a thermal distribution.
Limit on the reheat temperature 10 to the minus 5.
Yeah.
It's quite drastically different from what was reported by different groups 10 years ago or 5 years ago. It was 10 to the minus 9 or 10 to the minus 7. So I remember their review of results around 2000, and it was something like 10 to the minus 7, not 10 to the minus 5.
Well, I mean, I would say during the last, I mean, there are essentially two. Mostly, I think, two groups doing these things. So this is the Japanese group, and then Keith Olive and company. And I think within a factor 10, they typically agree. Now, here, this 10 to the 5 makes a very drastic, I mean, it's the worst case scenario, where you assume that the gravitino decays just into, with branching ratio 1, into gluon-gluino. Then you have hadronic energy, and then you have the biggest effect on BBN. If you weaken that, you can go up to 10 to the 6 or so reheating temperature, but you are always a couple of orders, three orders of magnitude below what you need for leptogenesis. I think there is a consensus on that. You know, I don't see that from the BBN constraints you can, I'm not an expert, so I can't judge myself, but just looking at the literature and comparing the work of different groups, there is not more than a factor 10 difference. Yeah. Yeah, but when was that? Yeah, yeah, but this is an analysis 2005. Well, okay, well, yeah, you say nuclear physics has not changed, yeah? What happened in these codes? Well, I'm not an expert on that.
The traditional bounds were only for electromagnetic decay, which is lower. If you don't assume a special thing, you will produce a lot of hadrons, and this justified the newest analysis, which give much stronger bounds.
Yes, but I mean, even if you now, if you would, I would say very artificially, completely suppress the decay into gluon-gluino and say it's just a Beano photon, okay, then you may go up to 10 to the 7. But then it's still two orders of magnitude.
Okay, thank you for that discussion. We should thank our speaker again.